Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. In recent years, we have witnessed the rise of a number of political and socioeconomic movements around the world, from revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt to Tea Party protests, the Occupy Wall Street movements here in the U.S. Some have characterized these events as naturally developing as a sign of grassroots, ground-up social movements. Others have suggested individuals or organizations or even nations have played a role in their development. Another question is just how significant a role social networking sites like Facebook and Twitter have played in helping to mobilize such protests. It's easier than ever today for like-minded communities of people, even separated geographically, to communicate and to mobilize. But our guest today warns there are limitations to the role social media can play in our society and that face-to-face assembly is still critical in order to further democracy. Todd Gitlin is a professor of journalism and sociology and chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. He's also a former president of Students for a Democratic Society and was active politically in the New Left of the 1960s. He's written many books. His newest is called Occupy Nation, The Roots, the Spirit, and the Promise of Occupy Wall Street. And he's on the University of Illinois campus today to give a free lecture at 4 p.m. in the Knight Foundation. The Knight Auditorium, as part of the Center for Advanced Studies MillerCom Lecture Series. Todd Gitlin, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, Craig. Pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you with us. And as we begin our discussion of social media and its potential benefits and limitations in the world we live in today, we welcome you to the conversation, even through said social media. You can comment via Facebook or Twitter. We are at Focus580 on both of those sites. You can also call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Has social media changed the game at all for social movements?
Yes, but the game for social movements is always in flux. There was a time when the telephone changed the game for social movements. There was a time, you mentioned my life in the 60s. I worked, I wrote for and at one point edited an underground newspaper, so-called, in the late 1960s. That was made possible by photo offset technology. Now, you could cheaply produce a weekly newspaper without having a lot of expensive equipment on your own. That, in certain ways, changed the game. I mean, there was a time when the mimeograph machine, which maybe some of our listeners have heard of or actually remember, changed the game. Certainly radio changed the game. There was a time in the late 18th century when pamphleteering changed the game. People went to salons in Paris to hear gossip, and then some of them went off and printed off the gossip and circulated and actually made some money on it. That changed the game. Television certainly changed the game, and so on and so on. So my point is that it's not as though there's a fixed game. You know, communication, in fact, is a staple of human life, but it is not a fixture. And I think it's a safe guess that for all of modern history, each generation has found itself being sat down at a table where an old game was being played, and then sort of gravitating to new variants on that game until it was left for them to feel obsolete when the youngins came along. So that's the nature of the game.
I guess the question is always for each generation, is this new change, this new development, whatever the technology is, whatever the communication move forward we've developed is it bigger than the last one? Is it more significant, more long-lasting, more influential than previous?
I can give you a definitive answer to this question. The answer is we don't know, and we can't know. I once thought about the changes that had taken place in the generation just when my father was born and just before that. There was a period of about 20 years. This is actually mostly before he was born, when what came into the world were movies, were automobiles, it was radio. Now, was that a lesser transformation that has taken place in our time than with, let's say, intercontinental jet traffic, television, and the internet? I don't know. I mean, those are pretty substantial. Moving pictures, radio, and automobiles. I mean, the automobile by itself transformed the face of the American topography. It changed the landscape. So, you know, I just don't. I'm a principled agnostic on this. That said, the ability. I mean, let's just take what's going on right now. You and I are sitting in a studio. We're having a conversation, and yet we're also aware that it's not as if the two of us were sitting in a car by ourselves or walking down the street together. We're carrying out a conversation which has, in a sense, eavesdroppers. And the eavesdroppers, you know, sort of, I'm aware. I mean, I don't know. I probably wouldn't be gesturing the way I'm gesturing right now if you and I were in a one-to-one, face-to-face conversation without the surrounding presence of the sort of the other shadow potential, et cetera, participants in the conversation. So, you know, I think our, you know, part of what modernity is a sort of nonstop jolt to what you thought was normal, and a sort of a different sense of what it means to be with a person. I'm with you right now in a way that was not possible a century ago.
Well, and I guess what occurs to me is the leap forward that we have taken is that we have reached a point now where anyone, virtually anyone, can communicate with virtually anyone or any number of people in any number of ways. And that maybe is a change that's beyond just the advent of radio and television and in each of those individual mediums. Now it's if you want to reach a million people with a message via text, you can do it. If you want to reach them via audio or video, you can do it, and all from a device in your hand.
Well, the operative word of what you just said is can. Everyone can, to quote an old AT&T commercial, I think, reach out and touch someone. However, if you think about it, the very ability to broadcast messages means that everyone lives in a state of nonstop noise, with this nonstop media torrent. And therefore, let's not assume that there are no longer structures of authority and power. There are no longer preferences. I mean, if I paid equal attention to every message that everyone was beaming at me by every means possible, I'd be berserk. I would be like the character in Borges' great story, Funes the Memorius, a guy. The sad story of a man who has a perfect memory and therefore is completely unable to function, because no sooner is he off in one direction than he's plunged back into a memory of something that took place. There isn't for him no present. Mm. So you know, there's some mystification here. And you know, we all like, I think, to believe in a technologically rich age that we're sort of always on the cutting edge, that, you know, sort of wonders have befallen us, and we can now, we have all sorts of human powers that you know, Louis XIV couldn't muster in his time and the pharaohs couldn't muster in their time. Yes, but we're also living a social life. I mean, that's sort of the big message, I think, of what I want to say here, that we live among media, but we don't live only among media. You know, we still get up in the morning and, you know, we still eat breakfast. You don't do that on media. And, you know, people still produce babies. They don't do that on media. And they sort of size up people they see on the street and try to figure out who they want to spend time with, and that's not strictly on media. So media and way of life are sort of enfolding. They're sort of mutually enfolding, yin-yang-ish sort of relationship. And so we got to be very careful about attributing magical powers to media as such, as if they were extraterrestrial, as if they'd just sort of drop down upon us to grace us or to torment us.
Or I imagine maybe part of the message is, or that they can replace the real world experience, that you can't do absolutely everything, absolutely all the time in an online world or in a social media world without having that face-to-face contact,
well,
that personal communication.
You know, it's like that line of from one of the Shakespeare plays, you know, I can summon I can summon powers from the vasty deep, but will they come when I summon them? I can send a message to anybody in the world, but will he listen? I can sign a petition to anybody in the world, but am I actually affecting anything in that process? Again, a certain measure, a certain calm is useful in appraising where we are.
It depends on what hashtag you put on.
Oh, I see. nobody's told me the secret.
So are sites like Facebook or Twitter, in your view, limited in their impact on the ability of social movements to flourish long term?
Yes, no, maybe. Let's talk cases, because I don't think you, I think generalizations are to generalize mistaken. Let's take the case of Egypt.
Okay.
In 2011. Now, I went to Egypt in March of that year. I interviewed a number of people. I gave some lectures. I sort of learned a thing or two. One thing I learned was that there was a famous Facebook group, a page called We Are All Khaled Said, which rallied a lot of people. And it was on through that site that the administrators called for demonstrations, among other places, in Tahrir Square on January 25th, 2011. Now, the site, Khaled Said was a young man, Egyptian from Alexandria, who was beaten to death by the secret police. And his photo, the photo of his horribly battered face, was shot by his brother in the morgue and uploaded, and it sort of made its way around. And then a Google executive named Wael Ghonim, who was feeling hostile to the Mubarak regime, decided to start this page, and it mushroomed. Now, that's true. It also is true, as I learned when I was there, this is not the first time that a photo of the victim of an atrocity had appeared online. In fact, I was told, the secret police themselves sometimes released videos themselves, showing themselves with impunity, smugly displaying their ability to actually wreck people. There were also a number of incidents after the self-immolation of the vegetable peddler in Bouazizi in Tunisia. There were several imitations in Cairo. There were at least five self-immolations, which did not provoke anything massive. So, many times people are calling for this, that, and the other, but people don't heed. Why did the particular Facebook group? Who knows? I mean, many people have thought they had found the key to summoning, to mobilizing people by using such groups. And not in the case of Occupy Wall Street in America, there'd been a number of earlier attempts to summon events with all kinds of spunky slogans and good graphics and a kind of zest to them and with some support from existing magazines and so on. And they did not trigger, a great upwelling. So, a certain modesty is required. Yes, it is helpful to it is helpful to movements to have the ability to, galvanize people. But ability is not a guarantee. Ability, it's not even close to a guarantee. And, when a lot of people are clamoring to a lot of people to get them to do a lot of things, not all of them, in fact, not most of them, are going to materialize. So there are mysteries.
Let's go back to Egypt for a second. I want to share a quote with you from Malcolm Gladwell, something he wrote in The New Yorker in early 2011 about his skepticism about the role of social media in the protests there. He said, "People protested and brought down governments before Facebook was invented. They did it before the Internet came along. Barely anyone in East Germany in the 1980s had a phone, and they ended up with hundreds of thousands of people in central Leipzig and brought down a regime that we all thought would last another 100 years. And in the French Revolution, the crowd in the streets spoke to one another with that strange, today largely unknown instrument known as the human voice." So I guess that gets back to your initial point that the technology itself shouldn't be thought of as the driver of social change, but it can be a vehicle maybe that supports it.
That's exactly right. And it should be added that many people had tried with pamphlets, with the human voice, with public address, with bullhorns, to galvanize social movements and failed. In fact, even the civil rights movement, which Gladwell rightly points out, you know, as a transcendently successful movement of recent history, is not generally the story we think it to be. For example, you will learn from your Illinois resident Northwestern professor Alden Morris's fine book, The Origins of the Civil Rights Movement, that there were a number of bus boycott movements in the Deep South in the late 1940s and early 1950s, before the famous Montgomery bus boycott, which were even in local terms successful. There was a successful boycott of the buses in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, for example, as I remember. Now, none of those became, you know, the spur for a whole wave. So why not? Well, you know, who knows? Who knows? I mean, in the end, who knows? So, you know, many, you know, this is not an exact science. We're not sending billiard balls to collide with other billiard balls when we organize, when we try to organize social movements.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing social media and the role sites like Facebook and Twitter play in society, particularly in regards to how they may or may not affect social change. Our guest is Todd Gitlin, professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University. He's also the former president of the 60s student activist movement, Students for a Democratic Society, and he's on the U of I campus to give a lecture today at 4 in Knight Auditorium titled "Social Media May Be Media, But They Are Not a Society." It's a free lecture, part of the Center for Advanced Studies MillerCom Lecture Series. We welcome your questions and comments for Professor Gitlin at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And, of course, it'd be foolish if we didn't ask you to, you know, consider posting your comments or questions on Facebook or Twitter or on both sites at Focus 580. The White House had a policy they put in place not too long ago, that if enough people signed a petition for their cause to be heard and delivered that petition to the White House, the Obama administration would hear the request and respond. Seemed like a, you know, pretty reasonable thing to do. These days, through social media, of course, it is very easy to get a large number of people to click, yes, I like, yes, add my name to this petition. And even for seemingly ridiculous positions. So, for example, the White House, following its own policy, issued a statement in response to what I assume was a tongue-in-cheek petition asking the federal government to build a Death Star, straight out of Star Wars. Then the White House changed the policy and increased the number of signatures to try and separate the wheat from the chaff. Is this an example of how a seemingly large online community may not really be that? That it's too easy to claim a connection to a movement when all you have to do is click a mouse?
The answer is a resounding yes. So-called slacktivism is you know, as easy, I was going to say, it's as easy as getting out of bed. It's actually easier than getting out of bed because you can like a page or sign a petition without even getting out of bed. There was a famous article by a sociologist named Mark Granovetter called The Strength of Weak Ties, which was very influential in sort of promoting the Facebook movement. And basically the idea is that there are all kinds of things you can get done, not by going to your intimates, not by going to your family or your closest friends, but actually breaking out of your circles. Because while your circle may be sort of self-referential, you all know the same people and so on, but maybe, you know, the plumber with whom you have a weak tie actually also knows somebody who actually can get your kid a job. But you'd have to break out of the circle. You'd have to capitalize on the weak ties. So obviously this is true. I mean, there's certain things you can get done via Facebook or Twitter or any of this. But there are also lots of things you can't get done. And that's in part because when the volume of people reaching out to each other becomes overwhelming, then people have to build in limits. The White House decided to build in a limit. Personally, you know, many of us that find ourselves unplugging from Facebook or, you know, sort of unsubscribing from email solicitation, if you can figure out how to do that, because the clutter becomes the story and it becomes difficult to distinguish signal from noise.
I want to get back to that issue of people sort of unplugging from social media in a little bit. But first, I want to sort of peer a little more deeply into this one point. Do you think too many people today feel like clicking support on Facebook of some organization dedicated to something, you know, relief in Darfur or something like that, that that is enough of a demonstration of their commitment to a cause that maybe it is for some replacing what might be real world activism.
Well, yes, except that there have been ways, whenever there are social movements, there are different layers of commitment. There's a core of arduous workers, dedicated people, and then there are outer circles ranging all the way out to people who do very little. You know, they wear a button to affiliate with something, or they sign a petition. And a social movement that with teeth and legs is one that's a full service movement. It offers points of entry for people at many different levels of commitment. So the problem is not so much that there are many petitions to sign. The problem is that the signing of petitions doesn't add up to a social movement. A social movement has to have a core of people who learn from experience, who trust each other. And I don't think that can be done without face-to-face relationships. So that the big successes, you know, or partial successes in movements of the last couple of years happened when face-to-face communication when social media communication led to face-to-face communication. If the Facebook group, We Are All Khaled Said, had just been a Facebook group, it would have dissolved into the air. It became the core of a great political transformation because people were summoned and agreed to go to a specific place. Zuccotti Park in New York became the center of a face-to-face movement that was summoned through electronic links.
Again, this is the Occupy Wall Street.
Yes, but if it were strictly, you know, a chorus of likes and dislikes on Facebook, you know, would just be more noise.
However, I imagine some looking back on the Occupy Wall Street movement and the fall of 2011, which then once it was sort of broken up by the end of that fall, that maybe all it was itself was a certain amount of noise.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I think it actually had a huge effect on the presidential elections and on the continuations that are now possible. I use the word promise of Occupy Wall Street in the subtitle of my book for that reason. I think the Occupy movement, as it emerged, turns out to have been more of a moment than a movement. But if we can get into why I think this, I do think that it actually did transform the political landscape, even if in the process it lost its ability to exist. It's a moment within a trajectory, and I don't think it can be revived as what it was. I don't think it. I mean, there are phases, you know, of movements, and some involve success, some involve failure. There were years when the civil rights movement, which we now think of as sort of a series of glorious epiphanies, when Martin Luther King gave speeches, but there were long periods for King for maybe 5 years when he and his organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, were pretty much lost. They tried this, they tried that, it didn't work, they weren't getting anywhere. Enormous frustration. I'm not saying that the Occupy movement will return in the form it came to us a year and a half ago, but I disagree that it left no trace.
So if it left no trace, how did it influence the political legs of the coming year,
well,
year and a half?
I mean, just here's some facts, and then I'll throw an interpretation in. Obama seemed to send a signal with his Labor Day speech just about a week or two before the occupation of Zuccotti Park in New York that he wanted to move in a progressive direction. And then he was encouraged to continue in that direction. But it wasn't just him and other prominent Democrats like Nancy Pelosi who were, let's say, cautiously welcoming of the Occupy movement. But I think even the Republicans sensed there was something big here. Because if you looked at the polls on issues about taxation and inequality and so on, most people were supportive of the general stance of the Occupy movement. It's actually little known. I have some of the details in the book that this is actually the first social movement since we have public opinion polling, in which there was a mass supermajority support for the main thrust of a social movement. The civil rights movement was not popular when it began. Even the industrial union movement of the 1930s, which was the first one that was polled, because that's when they started, 35 was Gallup's beginning. Even that movement, people showed a lot of ambivalence about how they felt about CIO leaders as opposed to captains of industry and so on. Anti-Vietnam War movement was enormously unpopular when it began. So in this case, what happened is that the Republicans, I think, very quickly recognized they better not get on the wrong side of this. Then something very interesting happened. Newt Gingrich crashed and burned. And before he flamed out, he was the recipient of a $10 million gift from Sheldon Adelson and his wife for big commercials. And they decided to put the commercials into damning Mitt Romney as a vulture capitalist. Pretty funny coming from, you know, the gambling tycoon Sheldon Adelson. But anyway, it didn't do anything for Gingrich's campaign, but it did a lot for the Obama campaign. The Obama people realized that tack had enormous potential. And so I think this helped bury Romney.
So you think the narrative that ultimately was derived from the 2012 campaign has its roots to some degree in the Occupy movement, which ultimately maybe got started a bit through social media?
I do. I think that, and social media and other things. I mean, the whole emphasis on the 1%, for example, probably got its popular spur from an article in Vanity Fair by Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, about the 1%. So, yeah, then the Occupy movement popularized that trope, 1%. And then, lo and behold, the Republicans nominated, you know, Mr. 1%. I think by that time, this was not a good time to be a candidate from the 1%.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing social media and the role sites like Facebook and Twitter can play in society, politically, economically, socially, but also particularly in regards to how they may or may not affect social change. Our guest is Todd Gitlin. He's a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University, and he is on the University of Illinois campus to give a lecture today at 4 o'clock in Knight Auditorium. It's titled Social Media May Be Media, But They Are Not a Society. It's a free lecture, part of the Center for Advanced Studies MillerCom lecture series. We welcome your questions and comments for Professor Gitlin at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or post your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter. We are on both sites at Focus 580. And we will have more after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we are talking today with Columbia University professor Todd Gitlin about social media and its role in our society, both in terms of benefits and limitations when it comes to its place in democracy, particularly when it comes to social movements from Occupy Wall Street to the Tea Party movement to the revolutions we witnessed in recent years in Egypt and Tunisia. We welcome your thoughts about the role sites like Facebook and Twitter can or should play in our society and where you think they are limited as vehicles for social change. You can give us a call at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. Find us on either at Focus 580. Phone numbers again, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. We were talking earlier about the idea of taking a break from social media and that people are starting to do this a little bit more. A new Pew Research Center study out this week indicates some 61% of Facebook users responding to a survey reported taking a break from the site for several weeks in the past year. 20% of adult online users reported once using Facebook but not doing so now. The main reason cited, not surprisingly, is that it can be a time suck. That you can spend a lot of time on it very easily. Another reason, though, had to do with the comments of their Facebook friends. They characterized those comments as, in some cases, stupid or crazy. There were things that they were reading on their news feed that just infuriated them and they just didn't want to bother with it anymore. I bring this up because Facebook is sometimes cited as sort of a little microcosm of society that, you know, you connect with people there that might share your interests or might not, that if you connect up with old friends from high school or former coworkers or people that you don't have very tight connections with, the strength of weak ties again, that you may find opinions presented there that are wildly divergent from your own or, you know, in wild political extremes. And so,
or you know, little details of personal life that you just don't care
about.
You know, I don't care about the bar mitzvah of somebody who, the child of somebody I haven't seen for 50 years.
If more people tune out those messages, only pay attention to messages with which they agree or they, you know, really filter out to such a degree that it's all about their insular life, how can social media serve to engage those people in public discourse?
Well, it can engage, as was true with the internet before that. People can be engaged, you know, by being mobilized into communities of the like-minded. And so there's been a whole lot of concern, I think, with some reason about the propensity of the internet to, you know, assemble self-contained bubble groups, you know, sort of people who live inside the universe of Fox News and don't believe anything that's not been ratified by O'Reilly or Hannity or you know, formerly Glenn Beck.
But the same could be said on the other side of the political.
Of course,
side,
yeah,
right?
No, but I mean, it's a political. You know, again, I think this is not the first time people have lived in affinities. There's sometimes some sort of romance that in the 19th century, all American politics was high-minded and honorable, and, you know, everything was Lincoln Douglas debates. I mean, partly what was so amazing about the Lincoln Douglas debates is how unusual they were. Because most political discourse in America in the 19th century was a whole lot of snarling and insult and scandal mongering and a whole lot of lying. You know, people living in closed worlds where they convinced each other that, you know, Thomas Jefferson was the Antichrist or something like that. So, again, none of this is new because of social media. But I think when people unplug, what they're essentially doing is trying to take back, you know, command of the sphere in which they feel comfortable. And that's not a bad thing, given how much clamor there is for attention. And given the fact that nobody's invented a way to have more than 24 hours a day, the ability to command attention, you know, is a kind of power, and people feel overpowered. So, you know, there is some, I think, utility in you know, repossessing one's, you know, one's control of one's most intimate availability. And you know, I'm also reminded, you know, when I think of, you know, the wonders of being able to, you know, pry into other people's lives. I remember at some point when I was a kid, when, God help us, tape recorders were pretty uncommon in my world. And somebody, one of my friends, had gotten a tape recorder. And so we decided to tape a session of us playing penny poker. Mm-hmm. So so the tape was on for hours. And then I played it back. And, you know, it was unlistenable. Who cared? You know, there was a lot of mumbling and, well, you know, trivia. And so, and nobody would want to hear it. And I think a lot of the Facebook commerce is static that sort.
No question. There's a lot of mundanity there. But getting back to this notion of blocking out political discourse with which you disagree.
I don't think that's what's going on when people unplug, by the way.
It may not
I don't think
be.
They're unplugging from MSNBC or Fox. I think they're unplugging from too much information.
But there are, I mean, anybody that spends a fair amount of time on social media, on any of these sites, particularly a site like a Facebook or Twitter, where you have access to lots of different points of view and maybe are dealing with people that you wouldn't in everyday life deal with. You're going to hear extreme political points of view. They're right there before you. And your choice then is, do you want to block that messenger? Mm-hmm. Do you want to specifically, actively say, this person may be a Facebook friend of mine, but I don't like this person's points of view on certain issues, and it just annoys me, so I'm going to block them so I don't have to read it anymore.
I don't know how common that is. I mean, I'm sure Facebook knows.
Yeah. But I'm wondering what it – if we find more people veering in that direction, trying to customize their online world to reflect their real world points of view in terms of what's coming back to them, does that lead to a less engaged
electorate? Well, again, I mean, this is a case for research. Which, for all I know, Facebook is doing. It's not clear to me how many people are using Facebook to collect points of view or reinforcement or circulate petitions or so on, as opposed to, you know, telling people what they had for breakfast that morning or, you know, what mommy or daddy is up to. Or, you know, I mean, I've seen, you know, death notices. I've seen, you know, announcements of divorce, you know, sort of looking for dates and all kinds of things. And so it's not clear to me what people are trying to avoid is discrepant political broadcast as opposed to just noise.
We talked earlier about the social media connections to the Occupy movement. We have an email from Grace who would like to know about the connections to the Tea Party. Mm. She says, I've read that Occupy really disrupted the Tea Party. Can you speak about this? And she said, you know, I heard you speak about the Republicans, but I'd like to hear more about the Tea Party, if possible.
Well, the Tea Party, is a fascinating media phenomenon because it was in some ways summoned into existence through old media. If you remember, the call for this tax revolt on April 15th, 2009, came from a tirade delivered on an old-style cable network, CNBC, by Rick Santelli, calling for an uprising in the form of the Tea Party and so on. He was talking about a particular tax policy. Mm-hmm. And then it mushroomed. And, of course, the same networks that – or equivalent networks were used by the Tea Party people as were later used by the Occupy people. In fact, it could be that more so. I don't know if anybody's got research on this, but we know quite a lot because of very good research. And I'll just mention the book by Theda Scotchpole and Vanessa Williamson called The Tea Party and the Revival or something of American conservatism. We know a lot about who the Tea Party people were demographically. They were wealthier than the norm. They're better educated than the norm. They are whiter than the norm. They're more married than the norm. And they are disproportionately fundamentalist Christians. People, leave aside the fundamentalist Christian part, and they're also older. Most of those variables point toward more conservative people, wealthier, better educated. These are people who are more likely to be wired up or wirelessed up. So I think that, you know, anybody wants anything done now, whether it's the building of a Death Star or, you know, the overthrow of the government of the United States of America, is online doing it.
And unless it's hope the folks that want to overthrow don't get access to a Death Star. That's the most important.
maybe they deserve to get access to it and then sail on through the galaxy.
We might be moving in a direction we don't need to go with today's show. But okay, this is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there is still time for your questions or comments for Professor Todd Gitlin at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Those phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Mitra is in Urbana. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, there was a rumor, I don't remember how many years ago, but about Facebook being owned by the government, like being bought out by the government, and I was wondering if that was true.
All right, I have not heard that one.
It is not true. It is not true.
It's interesting, though, that comes back to this idea that you raised earlier in the hour of there's this notion that anything that springs from social media comes from some sort of grassroots concept that it builds up, it bubbles up from, you know, people on the ground, and it's, you know, and there's a naturalness to the movement, and it's, there's not any one actor behind it or group of actors behind it. But in some cases with certain things, and it could be the Occupy movement, it could be the Tea Party, there may be organizations, there may be media outlets, there may be people with deep pockets who have a significant role to play.
Well, the tiny, partial, modest grain of truth in the paranoia is that the entire internet is built on an infrastructure that was funded by a government agency, the Advanced Research Project Agency, going back into the 1960s. That doesn't mean that the messages were controlled by the government. It means that the devising of the means to spread messages around through the various means that the internet uses, though they were initially government-sponsored. So were, you know, cable television would be impossible without the Comstat, I think it was called, a 1960s program to spin off from a government grant the communication satellites, which had been developed with taxpayer money. So there's nothing new about states playing a role. For that matter, you know, the post office, back in the news today because we're about to lose Saturday Mail, post office was set up by, guess who? The U.S. government. I mean, it's sort of the foundational communications means of the early republic. So the state is often in there in terms of developing, you know, the infrastructure and investing in it. But then that's that.
I want to come back to this idea that we were talking about earlier in regards to the role social media can play, but its limits when it comes to social movements, that that you can't use Facebook and Twitter or something like them on their own as the movement itself, that there needs to be this notion of physical assembly to a certain point. That's your contention, but I'm wondering, as someone who was so active in the 1960s, whether or not that skews your perception a little bit, almost in a way of saying, well, that may be what they're trying to do today, but kids today don't know, you know, how to really organize, you know, compared to the way we did it then.
Well, you know, I suppose it might sound that way a bit. If anybody said to us in the early 1960s, you know, your movement is predicated on telephones, you know, we would have sort of stared at them and say, duh, you know, well, of course it was dependent on telephones and the U.S. mail and so on. But you know, lots of people were using telephones for lots of, I mean, the Ku Klux Klan, I'm sure, was, you know, busy on the phone summoning their rallies. So, you know, again, whatever the on the edge, you know, cutting edge communication technology at the moment is going to be, you know, employed. But then to impute to it sort of decisive powers, that's what I'm objecting to. You know, there was an example I'll talk more about in my lecture this afternoon. After the overthrow of the communist governments of East Europe, Ted Koppel narrated a documentary called Television Revolution in a Box. And he maintained, as many people were doing then, that the reason there were these uprisings, the reason why communism collapsed is that people had access to television, and the television behind the Iron Curtain enabled them to see that people were living better in West Germany and France and the U.S. and so on. And therefore they said, you know, well, we don't need this communist government. That's very childish, that claim. You know, there'd been television for quite a long time without inspiring uprising. And for that matter, if Gorbachev hadn't been in power in the Soviet Union, it wouldn't have mattered how much television there was, because, you know, the Russians had been willing to repress uprising before. They would have done it again.
But do you think access to communication, or access to, in the case of a government system that restricts access to the outside world, if you get that access over time, and this is sort of the concept that's floated about how to move China towards more democratic processes, you know, involve them in trade, involve them in the outside world, and there will be this natural uprising over time, or this natural shift.
I don't think any of this is natural. I think it depends on so many acts of human effort and ingenuity. I know Chinese people who argue both sides of the case. There are those who think it's liberating now, and there are those who think it simply enables surveillance and that the government is smart enough to figure out how to, you know, how to round up the most dangerous people and to co-opt the less dangerous people. Who knows? You know, ask me in 100 years.
What then, in your view, can and should be the role of social media in social protest movements in the future?
Well, to assemble people who don't otherwise know each other, whether they're people who might, let's say, be on a big university campus who would not necessarily meet each other unless they went to a rally, or in the case of internet publics, you know, people who might be in Beijing or in Biloxi, Mississippi, who you have something in common with. The ability to create a network of relations between such people who are not intimates is, you know, is the lifeblood. It's certainly the lifeblood of any social movement, of any political stripe, of any, you know, religious or cultural stripe. So the role is big. The ability to, I mean, I think it has democratic potential. If that means enlivening the possibilities for people to play a part in governing themselves and expressing their assembled opinions, I think that anything that expedites that creates a potential for democratic growth. But if it, as long as it stays in the pixels, it's only a potential.
So you still have to get up, get out of the house, and still talk to people.
Take off your pajamas.
So let me ask you in our final few minutes here, how has your social media habit changed in recent years?
I'm in the middle of a fast. In fact, I was on vacation last month, and I actually did unplug because I was without wireless for a week, and I actually felt graced by the silence, and I've been, you know, monitoring my own knee-jerk propensity to sort of inch back into Facebook. I've stayed completely out of Twitter since I came back. I mean, because you know, I do feel disjointed, and I think modern life is a life of disjointment, if that's a word, anyway, and it's like being, somebody once used this phrase, nibbled to death by ducks, it's not a productive state of mind. It's a, you know, I can distract myself in 100 ways, and you know, sometimes I'd rather, I think it's more productive for me to distract myself with a good book, or for that matter, a good basketball game. I don't feel deprived by having tuned it out. I figure anybody who really wants to get hold of me will figure out how to do that, and likewise, anyone I need to get hold of, I will figure out how to do that.
So you think this is not just a sabbatical, but maybe a permanent vacation from some of this?
It's a busman's vacation. I mean, I'm going to use it to tell people I'm going to be speaking at the University of Illinois, or, you know, I had an article in the Los Angeles Times, today, actually. So I wanted to tell people that it was there, like people to read it and so on. So I'll use it for that very limited, essentially PR purpose. But I'm not going to pay attention to who's on his way, who that I don't know is on his way into the hospital or getting married.
Just for the next occasional social movement to start up.
If it comes time when it seems that that's, you know, I mean, it's not a matter of principle. It's a matter of, you know, trying to get some handle around on my life.
Todd Gitlin is a professor of journalism and sociology and chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. His latest book is Occupy Nation, The Roots, the Spirit, and the Promise of Occupy Wall Street. He's on campus today to give a lecture at 4 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium as part of the Center for Advanced Studies MillerCom lecture series. That lecture is entitled Social Media May Be Media, But They Are Not a Society. The lecture is free and open to the public. Todd Gitlin, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
We welcome any additional thoughts that you may have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. If you know anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus but is not within our listening area, let them know. We stream the program live every day at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen back to past programs. Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up, again, visit the Focus page of our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, we'll listen to conversations I conducted in the last week with a famous court watcher and a famous virus hunter. First, I will talk with Nina Totenberg, NPR's award-winning legal affairs correspondent and this year's winner of the Illinois Prize for Lifetime Achievement in Journalism, about her coverage of the U.S. Supreme Court and some little-known facts about her life and career, including a story involving a speedboat, her head, and her husband, the trauma surgeon, springing into action on their honeymoon, by the way. It's a good story. Then we'll talk with Nathan Wolf, a virologist and epidemiologist who has been described as the Indiana Jones of virus hunting. We'll talk about his work in Africa and why globalization is making our society more vulnerable to pandemic diseases. Both Nina Totenberg and Nathan Wolf are speaking on the U of I campus on Monday. There is information about both events on our website. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen.